The trainmaster had heard it said that the directive was necessary to save the country. He could not know whether this was true or not. He had no way of knowing what was necessary to save a country. But driven by some feeling which he could not express, he had walked into the office of the editor of the local newspaper and demanded that they publish the story of his brother's death. "People have to know it," had been all he could give as his reason. He had been unable to explain that the bruised connections of his mind had formed the wordless conclusion that if this was done by the will of the people, then the people had to know it. He could not believe that they would do it if they knew. The editor had refused. He had stated that it would be bad for the country's morale. The trainmaster knew nothing about political philosophy, but he knew that that had been the moment when he lost all concern for the life or death of any human being, or of the country. He thought, holding the telephone receiver, that maybe he should warn the men whom he was about to call. They trusted him. It would never occur to them that he could knowingly send them to their death. But he shook his head. This was only an old thought, last year's thought, a remnant of the time when he had trusted them too. It did not matter now. His brain worked slowly, as if he were dragging his thoughts through a vacuum where no emotion responded to spur them on. He thought that there would be trouble if he warned anyone. There would be some sort of fight, and it was he who had to make some great effort to start it. He had forgotten what it was that one started this sort of fight for. Truth? Justice? Brother love? He did not want to make an effort. He was very tired. If he warned all the men on his list, he thought, there would be no one to run that engine. So he would save 2 lives, and also 300 lives aboard the Comet. But nothing responded to the figures in his mind. Lives was just a word. It had no meaning. He raised the telephone receiver to his ear. He called 2 numbers. He summoned an engineer and a fireman to report for duty at once. Engine number 306 had left for Winston when Dave Mitchum came downstairs. "Get a track motor car ready for me," he ordered. "I'm going to run up to Fairmount." Fairmount was a small station, 20 miles east on the line. The men nodded, asking no questions. Bill Brent was not among them. Mitchum walked into Brent's office. Brent was there, sitting silently at his desk. He seemed to be waiting. "I'm going to Fairmount," said Mitchum. His voice was aggressively too casual, as if implying that no answer was necessary. "They had a diesel there a couple of weeks ago. You know, emergency repairs or something. I'm going down to see if we could use it." He paused, but Brent said nothing. "The way things stack up," said Mitchum, not looking at him, "we can't hold that train till morning. We've got to take a chance, one way or another. Now, I think maybe this diesel will do it, but that's the last one we can try for. So if you don't hear from me in 30 minutes, sign the order and send the Comet through with number 306 to pull her." Whatever Brent had thought, he could not believe it when he heard it. He did not answer at once. Then he said very quietly, "No." "What do you mean, no?" "I won't do it." "What do you mean you won't? It's an order." "I won't do it." Brent's voice had the firmness of certainty, unclouded by any emotion. "Are you refusing to obey an order?"
"I am."
"But you have no right to refuse. And I'm not going to argue about it either. It's what I've decided. It's my responsibility, and I'm not asking for your opinion. Your job is to take my orders."
"Will you give me that order in writing?"
"Why, God damn you, are you hinting that you don't trust me? Are you—"
"Why do you have to go to Fairmount, Dave? Why can't you telephone them about that diesel if you think that they have one?"
"You are not going to tell me how to do my job. You're not going to sit there and question me. You're going to keep your trap shut and do as you're told, or I'll give you a chance to talk to the Unification Board."
It was hard to decipher emotions on Brent's cowboy face, but Mitchum saw something that resembled a look of incredulous horror. Only it was horror at some sight of his own, not at the words. And it had no quality of fear, not the kind of fear Mitchum had hoped for. Brent knew that tomorrow morning the issue would be his word against Mitchum's. Mitchum would deny having given the order. Mitchum would show written proof that engine number 306 had been sent to Winston only to stand by, and would produce witnesses that he had gone to Fairmount in search of a diesel. Mitchum would claim that the fatal order had been issued by and on the sole responsibility of Bill Brent, the chief dispatcher. It would not be much of a case,
not a case that could bear close study. But it would be enough for the Unification Board, whose policy was consistent only in not permitting anything to be studied closely. Brent knew that he could play the same game and pass the frame up onto another victim. He knew that he had the brains to work it out. Except that he would rather be dead than do it. It was not the sight of Mitchum that made him sit still in horror. It was the realization that there was no one whom he could call to expose this thing and stop it. No superior anywhere on the line, from Colorado to Omaha to New York. They were in on it, all of them. They were doing the same. They had given Mitchum the lead and the method. It was Dave Mitchum who now belonged on this railroad, and he, Bill Brent, who did not. As Bill Brent had learned to see by a single glance at a few numbers on a sheet of paper, the entire trackage of a division. So he was now able to see the whole of his own life, and the full price of the decision he was making. He had not fallen in love until he was past his youth. He had been 36 when he had found the woman he wanted. He had been engaged to her for the last 4 years. He had had to wait because he had a mother to support, and a widowed sister with 3 children. He had never been afraid of burdens because he had known his ability to carry them, and he had never assumed an obligation unless he was certain that he could fulfill it. He had waited. He had saved his money. And now he had reached the time when he felt himself free to be happy. He was to be married in a few weeks, this coming June. He thought of it as he sat at his desk, looking at Dave Mitchum. But the thought aroused no hesitation, only regret and a distant sadness. Distance because he knew that he could not let it be part of this moment. Bill Brent knew nothing about epistemology, but he knew that man must live by his own rational perception of reality, that he cannot act against it or escape it or find a substitute for it, and that there is no other way for him to live. He rose to his feet. "It's true that so long as I hold this job, I cannot refuse to obey you," he said. "But I can, if I quit, so I'm quitting."
"You're what?"
"I'm quitting, as of this moment."
"But you have no right to quit, you goddamn bastard. Don't you know that? Don't you know that I'll have you thrown in jail for it?"
"If you want to send the sheriff for me in the morning, I'll be at home. I won't try to escape. There's no place to go." Dave Mitchum was 6'2" and had the build of a bruiser. But he stood shaking with fury and terror over the delicate figure of Bill Brent.
"You can't quit. There's a law against it. I've got a law. You can't walk out on me. I won't let you out. I won't let you leave this building tonight."
Brent walked to the door. "Will you repeat that order you gave me in front of the others?" "No? Then I will." As he pulled the door open, Mitchum's fist shot out, smashed into his face, and knocked him down. The trainmaster and the road foreman stood in the open doorway.
"He quit," screamed Mitchum. "The yellow bastard quit at a time like this. He's a lawbreaker and a coward."
In the slow effort of rising from the floor, through the haze of blood running into his eyes, Bill Brent looked up at the 2 men. He saw that they understood, but he saw the closed faces of men who did not want to understand, did not want to interfere, and hated him for putting them on the spot in the name of justice. He said nothing, rose to his feet, and walked out of the building. Mitchum avoided looking at the others.
"Hey, you," he called, jerking his head at the night dispatcher across the room. "Come here. You've got to take over at once."
With the door closed, he repeated to the boy the story of the diesel at Fairmount, as he had given it to Brent, and the order to send the Comet through with engine number 306, if the boy did not hear from him in half an hour. The boy was in no condition to think, to speak, or to understand anything. He kept seeing the blood on the face of Bill Brent, who had been his idol. "Yes, sir," he answered numbly. Dave Mitchum departed for Fairmount, announcing to every yardman, switchman, and wiper in sight as he boarded the track motor car that he was going in search of a diesel for the Comet. The night dispatcher sat at his desk, watching the clock and the telephone, praying that the telephone would ring and let him hear from Mr. Mitchum. But the half hour went by in silence, and when there were only 3 minutes left, the boy felt a terror he could not explain, except that he did not want to send that order. He turned to the train master and the road foreman, asking hesitantly, "Mr. Mitchum gave me an order before he left, but I wonder whether I ought to send it, because I don't think it's right," he said. The train master turned away. He felt no pity. The boy was about the same age as his brother had been. The road foreman snapped, "Do just as Mr. Mitchum told you. You're not supposed to think," and walked out of the room. The responsibility that James Taggart and Clifton Losey had evaded now rested on the shoulders of a trembling, bewildered boy. He hesitated. Then he buttressed his courage with the thought that one did not doubt the good faith and the competence of railroad executives. He did not know that his vision of a railroad and its executives was that of a century ago.